Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Attention all theater lovers, this Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hi, John Schwab here from Curtain Call, and welcome to episode 139 of the Curtain Call Theater Podcast, the podcast that brings you backstage as close as you possibly can be, often while the shows are actually happening, to meet the people that make that theater happen. Just a quick reminder that you can download and subscribe to the podcast from the Apple Podcast app or from iTunes. That way your feed will be automatically updated when we release episodes. But you can also listen to us on many other fine podcast streaming services such as Stitcher and Google Play and iHeartRadio. So if you have a spare 30 seconds, please rate and review that podcast. That's our podcast. If you have, if you have that spare 30 seconds, help us reach more theater lovers out there around the globe. And now for this week's podcast. This week, we get to talk to another theater designer. I love sitting down with these professionals at the top of their game, and they are some of my favorite conversations, and this week's guest is no different. Richard Brooker has been involved in theater his entire life, and he didn't want to start out being on stage. It was an actor's life that he managed to dodge, which is, listen, that's a joke. I absolutely love my actor's life. The theater did call him, but he found out that onstage life wasn't going to be his passion. He did other jobs in the business on his way to finding out that sound was where he discovered a way to scratch his performance itch. So he found himself working on the New London Theatre production of Cats, yes, that one, and worked his way up to sound number one, and then he started mixing shows for about a dozen years before he started sound designing. And now he's one of the country's top sound designers, working on shows such as Dreamgirls and The Bodyguard, Funny Girl, Bennett Like Beckham, Annie, West Side Story, Sister Act, many, 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 many more. I caught up with him at the get-in of How the Grinch Stole Christmas at the new Wimbledon Theater, and I got to chat to him about his career, the difference a good and bad sound experience can be, and how to get into the sound game if you're interested, among a plethora of other topics. So, have a listen.
So that's first overloaded today, so it's kind of slow and sort of carrying lots of heavy stuff around.
Yeah.
And, not me, I hasten to add. I'm watching them carry heavy stuff around.
Well, you've got to a point in your career, haven't you, Richard?
Exactly,
you watch people.
Yeah, exactly. Although some would argue I'll probably never carry anything heavy. So there's lots of people fighting over space in the auditorium right now, over lighting and set and sound and whatever, so yeah.
I love walking into a theater and the get-in, walking through the bay doors. It was a hive of activity. It's really that's the initial point of everything kind of coming together for a show to get in, which is, God, there's a lot of people here as well. There are four or five trucks on this show?
Five trucks, I believe, yeah.
Wow.
So, yeah, 45 footers, so yeah. Okay. So it's quite a big tour.
And the producers will love us talking about this.
Yeah.
And this is just a quick stop. So this is only here for like a few days.
We're doing our production week here. So, and then we have performances on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and then the show moves on. So it's, this week's all about getting the show to a shape where we can present it to an audience, and then, as I say, Friday's the first audience.
Yeah. So tell me,
We met at a panel at Plaza.
We did.
And it was a fascinating panel because we, you know, you were just saying before we started recording that we don't often think about sound. Sound is one of those things where it's like you say, almost turn on and turn off. Mm. You know, it's or turn up or turn down. Yeah. People are going to say, oh, it's not loud enough or it's too loud. But there's so much more to that. So what was it? Let me take you back, if that's cool. What was it that got the, I don't know what it was, 12, 15, 18, 20-year-old Richard Brooker, like, how did theater kind of envelop you in? Or was it theater? Was it live events? What got you into sound design?
No, it was very much theater. My family had always been involved in amateur theater.
Yeah.
And my uncle had taken that on to a professional level, and he did musicals, but he was really an opera singer, so he was in Opera North. Mm. And so I'd always been around theater, even just from an amateur point of view, and done youth theater and so forth. And so at that stage in my life, when I was leaving school, what I really wanted to do, I thought, was be an actor.
Right.
But I'd had enough of school. I didn't really enjoy school. Yeah. So I didn't really want to go straight off to drama school or anything.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, I'll just do some stuff for a while. And I didn't have anything to do with theatre. I worked in various, you know, short-term jobs. And then I decided that if I was going to work in theatre, I should probably try and see if I liked that as an idea. So I got a job as a follow spot operator. On Cats, actually, at the New London Theatre, and loved it, had a great time. And so my first sort of foray into live professional theatre was lighting, and I knew it wasn't really for me, but I enjoyed the buzz of being around people and being in the space and like the hours and, you know, the life. So I knew it was for me as a way of life. Still thought I might like to be an actor. And I actually auditioned for a very low budget tour of a play that was based around World War One war poetry, so not really a comedy, and got a small role in that, and then it never happened. We didn't even get to rehearsals. There was no budget and everything, and that was like, for me, was like, I don't want to do that. I don't want to be an actor, I don't think, but I still have a desire to perform in some way. And eventually and slowly I moved over into sound, and as soon as I got behind a sound desk and was mixing something live, I was like, that's it, that's the performance I need, that's all I need, I'm doing this live, I don't need to be on the stage at all. So that for me was the big changing point for me, was like, yeah, I love sound, this is fascinating. And actually, harking back, if you go back into my teens, I was always messing around with amplifiers and speakers and things, and hadn't really connected that as something that I might like to do. It was just something I naturally did, like try and make that sound a bit nicer or whatever. So I kind of fell into it, but it was a very fortunate fall because it was right.
I think it's great that you, it happens, it always astonishes me the amount of people who said, oh, I started out in one part of it, or I wanted to be an actor, or I wanted to be a director or producer, or well, who wants to be a producer? You know, but
yeah, really.
But you know, I wanted to be a lighting designer. Yeah. I wanted to design, but and then it takes them a different way, and it's just important to find out what you don't want to do when you enter this business, as definitely. It is that you want to do, right?
Yeah.
And what was that first sound experience? Because you talked about mixing the desk, but what was it that just kind of really brought you around to sound?
I don't know. I think, as I say, there was just a connection that I felt I could do. You know, like there was a something in me that just felt like this. I can control this, and when I do, I get joy from that and appear to make the right decisions that other people like as well. Because, you know, the thing about sound is it's really subjective. Because you can't see it, and you can't point at it, and you can't, you know, people's vocabulary about sound, understandably, is quite limited.
Yeah.
It's either turn it up, turn it down, it's too loud, it's too quiet. You know, and of course, whilst that makes sense in the broader sense of the words, turning it up or it down doesn't make any sense, because what is it? You know, it's not normally a case of the whole thing is too loud or the whole thing is too quiet, and that's kind of one of the strangest things, I suppose. And it is something that I find fascinating and I find frustrating about my job, is that people outside of the sound world do find it very hard to express their emotions or their feelings or their criticisms or their comments about sound, and that means you've always got to overcome that. That sort of barrier, first of all, before you can actually start discussing anything creatively. And obviously, I'm making a generalization. There are people who can discuss it, but really, a lot of people do have a very limited vocabulary about what they want to say about the sound. And so you know, people will come and see a show and they'll say, oh, I love the costumes, I love the set, I love the lighting. And they won't say anything about the sound, and that's the compliment.
Yeah.
Nobody mentioned the sound, because generally speaking, people only ever say, well, the sound was really bad, I couldn't hear the words or whatever. So no comment is your pat on the back, really, I suppose.
Yeah.
Which, you know, could be better, but I'll take it.
Excellent. I would love to go back to your, as well, as just kind of a progression. So having discovered, you know, what were the first shows that you worked on that you really you cut your teeth on?
Yeah, well, I went back to Cats and was the sound number one on that eventually. Cats is a special place in my heart because it was my first ever show in the West End to work on, but it was also my first ever sound number one on a show. So so that was cool. I mixed shows in the West End for 12 years, mm-hmm. think. So I did quite a few. And I did two of my favourites were the transfers of Carousel and Oklahoma from the National Theatre into the West End. So they were great shows to work on. Big, lush scores with very big orchestras, but particularly with the size of orchestra we have now in the pit. You know, we had a lot of players in those, and it was a great, great experience to work on those. So.
Which Oklahoma was it? Who was in it?
So
was
Hugh Jackman. Lightman? And Hugh Jackman, who went on to do all right for himself,
Because I did see that one at the Nash. Yeah. And... Yeah. And it was big. It was talk about big sound. That was a lush big sound.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, that was good fun to work on. So then you learn your skill mixing. No, I mean, not every sound designer has ever been a mixer. It's fair to say that's not always the path.
Okay.
But certainly was my path. I was a mixer for years, and I suppose my first love is still mixing. I still love to mix music.
Yeah.
I went on to become an associate, do small designs for myself or take over as an associate designer for other established designers on successful shows.
Right.
And I spent nearly 10 years, I think, as an associate sound designer on Mamma Mia as it was doing its global takeover.
Push,
world takeover. and that was a fantastic experience. Obviously, I learned a lot, but also it was just an amazing sort of wonderful, out of control, successful train to be part of.
Yeah. So. Well, it must have afforded you the opportunity to see how different each theatre is and how it, the frequencies bounce off walls differently and material. Like the seats in this new Wimbledon Theatre will take in sound opposite, you know, completely differently than the Richmond Theatre.
Indeed, yeah, absolutely. So that, and that's part of learning the skill as a sound designer is to look at the room and make some decisions about it when you're designing it. Every theatre has its own different acoustics, as you said, and every theatre has its own problems from an architectural point of view. Mm. Particularly the older theatres, beautiful as they are, they weren't designed to hang speakers up in on the pros. So there's nearly always seating boxes sticking out exactly where you need to put speakers, etc. So, you know, and that's the same for lighting as well. Actually, quite a lot of lighting goes on the pros as well now, and we're all sort of fighting for real estate on the pros kind of thing. So, it's a challenge, and certainly the more shows you do, you cut your teeth on that and make some mistakes and learn some valuable lessons. And so I was very lucky to do that, and I'd done a few other shows as an associate. I used to do some stuff for Rug. I did Sunset Boulevard and Jesus Christ Superstar on tour for them. And then, you know, you slowly start getting asked to design things yourself, and so now I suppose I've been designing as an independent designer now for about 15, 16 years now.
So you guys can't see Richard. He looks not old enough to have all this experience. It's ridiculous.
It's just favourable lighting.
You talked about this is fascinating because I love how we've just talked about going from designing for something at the National, the team, the West End. How does a designer go, this is the show, and then you've got something that's on the stage as big as and open as the Olivier stage, and then having to transfer it into the West End on a different stage that isn't as cavernous or whatever. You know, how do you start off with your design going, I'm going to have to have some sort of a plan that will allow me to have a similar sound in the next venue as I do here?
Well, going back to what we were saying about the venue, the venue will dictate how you're going to deliver the sound in that space, because obviously something like the Olivier, as you say, is a very particular, peculiar space where it's massive and open, doesn't really have a proscenium arch in any way, shape, or form. So actually, as a space, not that I've ever designed anything there, but there's very few places to hang speakers where you want them to be. So therefore, it's a bit of a compromise. You have to move stuff around the whole process so that the combination of all of those speakers will give you your image. Because with sound design, you don't really want the audience to be listening to the speakers. You want them to believe it's coming from the actors and the orchestra and whatever. So, you know, that's achieved by, without going into too much boring detail, it's achieved by a mixture of location of speakers where you need them. And then timing. So timing is a very important thing in sound, as it is in comedy, but different type of timing. So this is sound actually moves really, really slowly. This isn't going to turn into a physics.
This is amazing. No, this is fascinating. Because I love this.
In combination, if you compare it to light, obviously light is lightning fast, but sound actually moves relatively slowly. So the old sort of demonstration of that is if you're watching a cricket match and you see the guy hit the ball and then like. I don't know, half a second to a second later, you hear the sound of it. That's because it travels relatively slowly and obviously not as fast as the light. So you see it, but you don't hear it.
Right.
So therefore, the human ear is very, very adept at spotting timing mistakes. And you would be surprised how accurate it is. But so when you want to, if you have a sound system with speakers all over the place, if you don't time them together, then it will be quite an incoherent mess of very slight timing differences between them all, which will just turn into a bit of a cacophony, and you'll get very strange frequencies sticking out or frequencies disappearing and so forth because of that timing push and pull. So the first thing you have to do is decide where your speakers go and then time them together, and then normally add some time to the actor's voice because the actor is maybe like a couple of meters further upstage than the speakers are. Okay, so then in order to time all this together, so we're talking about milliseconds. Everything's timed in milliseconds.
Course,
So millisecond, roughly speaking, sound travels about a foot or 30 centimeters as we are these days in a millisecond. So you know, roughly speaking, if you're sitting in the front row of the circle, which is 15 meters away from the stage, you know, that's going to take about 45 to 50 milliseconds to reach you acoustically. So if you don't make those changes in the sound system, then people will spot that. It will go wrong. And particularly, as I'm sure you're aware, we'll have delay speakers in the rooms that are further back in the room, which deliver clarity. Well, you don't want to pull focus to those.
Yeah.
You just want to make sure that people don't really know they're there, but they're delivering clarity. So they have to be timed back to the main system. Otherwise, you're going to hear them first and then the system. So it's, you know, sound is tied in with timing very, very crucially, you know. So
I can probably guarantee that most people listening to this podcast would never have taken that in. Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. So you have had quite a fantastic amount of experience at this point. Has the timing of those things, now talking about it, has the design become easier with tools, or has it become, because we cover this kind of in the Plaza talk, but has it become easier, or can you actually get lost in a quagmire of new technology?
I think there's definitely a danger to, you know, we're all interested in gadgets, of course we are, you know, so look at the gadgets you have here to record us, you know. Yeah. But you know, there is a danger to just going, what's new? Let's get that. I'm a mixture of the two, so I like to know that, particularly these days, quite often the production period can be quite short, which means you need to be able to achieve results quickly. So it's like anything, you need the right tools around you to know that. You know, that's the same if you're a chef or whatever. You need the right things around you to be able to guarantee getting a result quickly. So I tend not to change the basics that often. So but I will look at maybe a new reverb, or I will look at maybe this. But you also have to think, and we did touch on this before as well. You have to play fair. I think, you know, there is an industry out there which is the people who supply the sound equipment for the shows, and they're a rental company, and it is simply not sustainable for rental companies to have to go and buy something new for every single designer every single time that comes out, a new piece of kit comes out, because the rental that's paid weekly by the show doesn't represent that kind of, you know, that doesn't, it can't, cannot support that kind of outlay. So I think there's a whole bigger conversation maybe to go into about how sound, lighting, and video equipment is quite expensive stuff, you know, and obviously the more technology goes into it and the more it moves forward, it's not going to get cheaper.
No.
I mean, some things get cheaper, but it basically, I can only talk with any authority on sound equipment, so we'll stick on that for now. But, you know, it's very, very high quality, professional grade equipment. So that doesn't come cheap.
No, the R&D costs of any new technology
has
got to be recouped in a weekly rental.
So I think there are some advances in technology which have been absolutely incredible and have revolutionized what we do, not just for us, but for other departments as well. And so smaller radio mics, digital radio mics means we can have more radio mics within the same bandwidth, which was becoming an issue because the government was selling off all of the frequencies that we were using to digital TV, mobile phone, whatever. And that's a consumer demand thing, that, you know. So we were losing our frequencies and it was getting tougher and tougher. And then the manufacturers, you know, all the big players, Shure and Sennheiser and Sony, have there are others available.
Richard loves you all.
Yes. They've all come up now with a very small and fantastic sounding wireless system.
Okay.
So that's great for us. But it's also great for wardrobe. And it's also great for the actors. And it's also great for the wig department. Because now, quite often, the main players in a show who play the main principal roles, we all put two radio mics on them. Because nowadays, people don't expect failure, you know. So if and obviously technology does fail occasionally,
of course it does.
Or a microphone will fail because it gets some sweat in it, you know, which can happen, particularly in the summer. So having two packs and two microphones on the actor means that we've got a backup to flip over to.
Yeah.
But if those packs were large, that's quite a logistical issue for everyone involved, you know. So nowadays the packs are smaller. You can put them in the wigs, inside the wigs, more comfortable to wear on the body or whatever, and they don't produce ugly bumps in the costumes, and especially if they're tight costumes or whatever. So there's been some major advances which are absolutely worthwhile and worth buying into, and almost weren't an option not to do, you know.
Yeah.
But there are also interesting, very interesting ideas going on, and some of the manufacturers have brought out some fantastic speaker systems which approach the whole delivery of sound in a very different way. Now, that's very exciting for a sound geek like me.
Yeah.
But whether it's exciting enough for a rental company to have to go and purchase this entire new stuff and the processing, and it's not just one manufacturer, it's quite a few manufacturers that are doing this thing. You've probably heard of the term immersive sound, which is, you know, very, very in everything now.
Yeah.
Our audiences have become very different. And to answer your question, how has it changed things? You know, our audiences have become very different over the years. People now listen to their films in surround at home.
Yeah.
Even some people use computers which have sound systems that are in surround, or their PlayStation games, or their Xbox games.
Well,
games manufacturers are
available. Yes, exactly. Or my noise-canceling headphones.
Noise-canceling headphones. There's so much technology that people now not only love, but sort of expect.
Yeah.
So when they go and see anything live, they expect it to sound amazing. And as they should, they've paid for the ticket, it should sound amazing, and it should look amazing, etc., etc. But you also have a very lazy public now. No offense to anyone, but people, you know, they'll sit on the TV and they'll pick up their remote and...
Yeah.
No, they won't sit on the TV. They'll sit on the sofa and watch the TV with a remote in their hand, and they'll turn it up.
Yeah.
And they'll think, I can't quite hear that, I'll turn it up again. And so what we're losing is an audience who are prepared to listen. So, you know, in the old days, people didn't used to wear microphones, and the audience used to watch and stand up and go, can't hear you. No, they didn't. They used to watch and then concentrate and watch the show and be drawn in.
Yeah.
You know, and in order for people to buy into drama of any kind or buy into a character or an emotion, you need to draw them in. Okay, so what I fear is that there's a drive to make everything too loud.
Yeah.
And that comes from various places. It comes from the producers, it comes from the public. And if you're not careful and everything becomes very one level, the whole way through the show, there is no dynamic to it, no dynamic journey, then all you do is sit back and let it wash over you.
Yeah.
So then you don't get pulled into the storyline and you don't care anymore. I like it when, obviously you need to make sure people can hear, but it's there's no harm sometimes if people have to sort of lean forward
in,
and listen, and because it's an intimate moment. That's good. And in the same way, it's great when you knock them back in their seat with a huge show tune
or
whatever it is. And there's various reasons for it. As I say, I think it's certainly because people have that kind of lifestyle now. It's convenient. I don't want to try. You know, I don't need to try. I can just listen at home. But also, they now sell popcorn in theatres. They now sell sweets and crisps and drinks and things.
Yeah.
Which I understand why from a financial point of view, but all these things cause noise, and it means that everything has to come up. You know, again, no disrespect to my colleagues in lighting, but every single light now has a fan in it because they're moving lights and stuff like that. The ambient noise, if you just, nobody makes a sound and you just listen to a lighting rig, it's loud.
Yeah.
So everything has to come up above that really. So we're already much louder than we ever used to do shows.
Right.
And we're in danger of it all just becoming a bit too loud, I think. And I'm not against loud shows. I think it's great. I do quite a lot of rock and pop type shows myself, and they do need to be punchy and loud, but they still need to be dynamic.
Yeah.
And that's something I, in my designs, I campaign for all the time, is let's keep it a dynamic journey so that people, you know, people get drawn in and they feel the emotion, and then when the power comes, it's wow, it's really exciting. Otherwise, it's just a bland evening out, you know.
I totally agree. My son is he's going to go into sound. He loves sound. He's going to go into sound production. He's going to university. I know. I did say law. Jack, listen to Richard. But I said dynamics is key. Dynamics. If you just have a wall of sound, people will, you run into it, and they're no longer interested after a while. Just a couple more questions. How soon do you like to come onto the process? Because you were just talking about where in the clothes you can put a pack or two packs, what you can bring into the show, because that's a production call and producer call. Also, what the director might have in store. Like, how soon, how crucial do you think it is? At what point do you have to come into a show?
So normally, if there's such a thing as normally, you would be approached about your availability and interest in a project. And if you are available and interested, then you quite often be invited to go and meet the director, which is great, because you can sit down and find out what kind of show it is they're trying to do. Now, obviously, if it's a classic, Rodgers and Hammerstein classic, something that we all know, we kind of know what kind of show it's going to be. But if it's a brand new musical, then, you know, at the point you get asked, you're not necessarily sure whether it's an upfront poppy sounding show or a very, very lightly reinforced, almost sort of faux acoustic sound that everyone's after. So it's nice to have that conversation with the director. And the directors vary greatly. You know, some directors will say, have an enormous idea of what they want, lots of things to say, and other people go like, well, it's, I don't know, it's, I just know. I just need you to make it sound nice. And so it varies how that meeting goes. Probably more key meetings after that are with the music department, because that's where, you know, music and sound are sort of, they aren't the same department, but they're very, very hand in hand, obviously, and very key to each other. And so that relationship is extraordinarily important, and is always a great relationship. Yeah. Always get on very well with the music team. So this is all happening. It varies, but a good few months before you would consider going into production. Yeah. The problem is it doesn't always happen before the set has been designed. And that's the problem.
Wow.
Because the set designer comes up with a glorious set, a clever set, and, you know, and they are amazing sets. I have no idea how they do it, how they turn some ideas into something that's physically on stage. But very few of them ever remember there's going to be speakers on the press. And so quite often they get quite upset that you want to put speakers on the pros. And of course, it's not optional to have speakers on the pros. So it would be nicer sometimes to go be in the process at that stage.
Yeah.
So we go, well, let's put speakers on the pros, and then you can cover them up and put them behind gauze and we don't ever have to see them. But let's do that first.
Yeah.
And some shows it does happen where you're in earlier and you can be involved in those conversations. Sometimes you get involved and it becomes a little bit more of a battle, a sort of I'm really sorry, but I do have to put speakers on the pros. Well, how are we going to do it and stuff? So it could be smoother.
Yeah.
And again, I think this comes back again to there's absolutely nothing malicious or dismissive of it. I think it's just a lot of people still don't really understand how key the sound positions are, and so to it actually working. So, and I think I said this before where we met. I said to you, with theatre, it's very much considered to be a visual medium. So what you see, going to a night at the theatre is what you see, which is true. And there's a lot of visual mediums involved nowadays. Say that quite a lot of design goes into video projection, which is astonishing. You can do amazing things. But none of that is going to impress anyone if you can't hear what's being said or you can't feel the music and stuff like that. And I think that that's something I would really implore the other departments and all my other colleagues who I respect massively in all those departments to just remember, is that sound is not that irritating other thing that has to happen. It's just as key to the whole show happening and making it as an experience for everyone. You know?
Sure.
It's like if you were to go and watch a movie and couldn't hear any of the words or hear the music, you would go straight out and complain about it.
Yeah.
And, you know, and yet film couldn't be any more of a visual medium. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? So
of
I think it's just about... It's not me moaning that I'm unfairly treated. Don't get me wrong, I'm not. It's just it would be so much easier for us and everyone else if we were brought in at that stage and just discussed it all, how it's going to work. So yes, there is definitely some work to be done, I think.
Yeah. I think, you know, when I'm filming and when the sound recorder says, you know, one more for sound, you always do one more for sound because it is crucial. In fact, you can forgive a slightly out of focus shot. You know, you can forgive a slightly dim stage. If you can't hear what's going on, there's a real disconnect.
Yeah.
And it just goes back to the timing. I'm fascinated. I'm going to have to go do some research on the timing.
Well, listen, I've been doing sound, I think, for 30 years now.
Yeah.
And it's still fascinating.
Yeah.
I still learn something new and I still find it absolutely ridiculous that that's just happened, or that I can change the way something sounds literally with half a millisecond or something. Yeah, it's crazy, but it's fascinating.
Well, I think I've got one more question for you, but I think we need to continue this discussion with a round table like we had before and get, you know, an actor and a mixer and a board up, because I really think there's a lot to kind of delve into here. You know, talking about the actors speaking to sound designers and how that whole process is.
That relationship.
That relationship should be key.
Yeah, well, it could be a lot closer, certainly.
Yeah.
And probably should be.
Yeah.
But tech time is always so limited. And, you know, and like you say, you've already moved past that point suddenly without even realizing it, and then it's hard to go back. And so
there's one thing that was fascinating that we talked about at Plaza, and it was when it was Siobhan Harrison, the actor that was there, she said that, and there was a story that you were relating with, it was the diction wasn't coming through. Mm, it was you know, they couldn't, can you just, turn me up? And there was somebody in the audience said, I have a problem with the actors, you know, they're not being heard. Are they not being heard because of the diction or because of the way that they're talking? Because there's a different way. When I know I'm mic'd, I have a different voice, and I think that...
Yeah, I think
the crucial
problem with microphones is that they don't ever improve diction. They actually make it worse.
Oh, wow, okay.
Or rather, they exaggerate any problems.
Gotcha.
So, if you're lazy with the diction or in the way, or if you're mumbling under your breath, which might seem appropriate at the time, it won't be solved by the microphone. Yeah. That's, you know, you
just let everybody hear that you're mumbling.
Yeah, just mumbling really loudly. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. No, it's a fascinating thing. If you think about what we do, on a big scale musical, every actor has a microphone, some of them two. Every instrument in the pit has a microphone or two, depending on what type of instruments they are. So by the time we get to a normal size musical, very quickly gets up to close to 100 inputs on a console. You know?
Yeah.
So that's like mixing an enormous album live every night, if you like. So it's a lot to get done sometimes in the time we have, but I guess that's a challenge, is why we do it. A bit crazy, maybe. But yeah.
Great. Last one, Richard, one.
Okay.
If someone is interested, you know, and someone young that's going, you know, I've always been fascinated by sound, or I love toying with, or is a musician who goes, you know, I don't necessarily want to be a musician, but I want to be involved in not just theater. You talk about immersive theater, which is much more live performance thing. What's a great jumping off point into this career?
Okay, so there's two things I would say, is that when I first started out, there weren't so many courses available in live sound. There was a lot of studio sound stuff, but not so much live sound. So now there are. So there's some great courses. So the first thing you should do really is that you should do one of those courses. You know, places like Lipper do just fantastic work. Everybody that Lipper churn out of their sound course is amazing. I've found so far, they're great. So that's your practical and your actual sort of education type experience. But the thing you need to do is network and offer your services for free. Can I come and help and meet you guys? And I obviously don't want to be paid, or, you know, while you're still a student.
Yeah.
It's really key to meet people. And one of the most important things about a sound mixer, certainly, is and probably anyone in the sound department, but communication is what we do. You know, sound is all about communication.
Yep.
So you need to make sure that you're an open person who can discuss things and have an open mind about how to do things. So, but yeah, I would say if someone wants to get into it, contact people. You know, these days you can find out how to get in touch with people very easy. Okay, with the internet. So send an email saying, I'm in my last year at school. I really want to go into sound. I think, but I don't really know what to do.
Yeah.
And I see you're at this theatre this week. Can I come down one evening and meet you and just ask you a couple of questions? Understand your times, you know, all that kind of thing. But I respond to that. You know, I think people who've shown initiative immediately go to the top of the list of people who I'd be interested in using in the future.
100%.
There is no one way of getting into it. There's no sort of careers path that you have to take. But I think it's important now. People maybe don't take you quite seriously if you haven't done a course of some description. Yeah. In live sound. So.
Excellent. Well, Richard, thank you so much for your time. I know there's still a get-in happening across the corridor there.
I'm sure they haven't missed me in the slightest.
But let's continue this discussion and let's do our roundtable.
Yeah, that'd be great. Listen, thanks very much for asking me. This has been really interesting.
A pleasure.
Sound designer Richard Brooker there. Before I go, just a few housekeeping bits. If you're a theater professional, head on over to curtaincallonline.com and sign up for a free profile page. All you have to do is create an account with an email address, make up a cool password, and away you go. You can follow us on all the socials, Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Curtain Call, and you can follow me at John Schwab. That's John with an H. We'd love to hear from you if you have any suggestions or feedback from the podcast. Get in touch with us via any of the social media platforms I just mentioned, or write to me personally at john@curtaincallonline.com. Also, if you guys are looking for a networking opportunity that comes along once a year, where you can rub shoulders with producers and stage managers, directors, casting directors, you name it, basically anyone you need to meet to put on a show, you need to go to tppsuperconference.com and get your tickets today. It's in New York, but it's a great time to go to New York because it's just before Thanksgiving. You still find some good deals. November 16th and 17th, the Super Conference is on, and you should go. If you're a theater maker and you are creating, you will increase your tribe no end. Don't forget to use the code CURTAIN19, which is all uppercase, to get your discount. Book it. Make sure you find us when you're there. It just leaves me to say a huge thank you to Richard Brooker. You can find the video of the panel at Plaza, which we mentioned. That's the Professional Lighting and Sound Association Trade Fair. We had a fascinating chat with a wide range of guests from designer to actor, and that's there on the Shure website, and I will put a link to that in the show notes. And speaking of the wonderful people over at Shure, I'd like to thank them for the new microphone I used this episode of Curtain Call. We used the MV88, plugs right into your iPhone or Android, works a treat. Thank you so much, guys. It was really great. Really, really great. Look forward to using it again. Thanks for listening to the Curtain Call Theater Podcast, and I will catch you all next week. Bye.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.
If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.